I want to talk to you today about the touch that makes whole. But I want to talk to you today from a perspective not of Bronson James. In fact, sometimes the preacher doesn't feel like preaching, so he's not here today. But never mind, I'm not channeling anything. But I want to talk to you today from the perspective of one who might have lived a long time ago. So I would like to introduce myself to you today. My name is Aaron Ben Jairus. Aaron, son of Jairus. You've heard of my dad, I'm sure. I hope you will become more familiar with him. And all I want to do is be a storyteller. I don't want to be an impediment. I don't want to get in the way. I don't want you to think, well, has he slipped a cog? I mean, he's talking about talking, letting somebody else speak for him. No. There's a witness that might have been overlooked. As I said, there are things that are written in the Bible that leads one to say, well, I don't understand why God did that. I don't know why he insisted on going that particular direction. Let's look at one of those in Leviticus. Leviticus 15. You find something utterly fascinating written there. I used to hear my dad when he went about his responsibilities in the synagogue. Remember, my name is Aaron Ben Jairus. And I used to hear him and the elders discussing this passage. Leviticus 15. Beginning in verse 25. It's one of those passages that it's hard to quite understand. I mean, the theologians and the commentators have struggled to try to understand why God did what he did here. It says, and if a woman have a hemorrhage, an issue of her blood many days, an extraordinary hemorrhage, not the one that is common to women, the monthly cycle, but this is a different one. Out of the time of her separation, or if it turned beyond the time of her separation, all the days of the hemorrhage of her uncleanness shall be as the days of her separation. She shall be impure, unclean. Now, that is an uncomfortable passage. It's uncomfortable because it talks about a bodily function that is common to half of the population of the world, but we don't want to talk about it. It goes on to say, everything she touches, whether it's the bed she lies on in verse 26, or whatever she touches, including other human beings, shall be unclean. It goes on to verse 30, talking of this state. In chapter 12, however, another aspect of it is introduced because it says there that once she delivers a male child, she shall be impure or unclean for 40 days. Where's the unfairness? Well, if she has a female child, it'd be 80 days. Why? What is it about male and female in the birthing process that would require such a distinction? Is God fair? Many have tried to wrestle with that. Well, it must be because of this, and doctors and physicians have tried to understand it. It never quite adds up for 80 days for the female, though. They attempt to explain it. God doesn't. It just, there it is. There it says it. But this impure state. Now, men can be unclean as well for emissions or for difficulties of all kinds that would cause them not to be able to partake of the ceremonies of the temple. But this question, this, if you will, issue, seems to question whether God is fair. When I was growing up, watching my dad go through his functions, you see, my dad was the president of the synagogue where I grew up. Mark makes a record of it in the fifth chapter. But I want to fill in some of the gaps, and that's why I'm here today. I want to fill in some of the gaps that you might not have considered in going through this story of Jairus, my dad, the ruler of the synagogue. As the ruler of the synagogue, he was responsible for organizing it, for the services that were provided there. He was responsible for making sure the building was cared for and taken care of. And he was an important man in the community, to be sure. His importance and the respect that he garnered, you see, made it nice for us because we didn't have to wait online, you know, when it was time to eat. When there was a chili cook-off, we could get in the front of the line because my dad, you see, was an important man. But there was a downside to it as I was growing up because, you see, when it was time to go, when I was ready to go and play and have fun and do the things that children do, my dad was occupied in talking to others and sharing and fellowshipping. And you know how children are. It's time to go. There are things we have to do, but I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to hang around while my dad carried out his responsibilities. But it goes with the territory, you know. He was not a preacher. He was just the ruler of the synagogue, but I can understand it. I can have a sympathy for the preacher's kid. The PKs, we call them, you know. If you're a preacher's kid, people look at you differently, and they have different standards for you, and all of that kind of thing. And even if your dad is the ruler of the synagogue, it goes with the territory. As we grew up, my sister and I, there were the normal bumps and bruises of childhood, but my mom and dad could always make it right. They could always take care of it. They could always nurse us and comfort us and quiet our fears. My dad, my mom loved us and cared for us, and they nurtured us as youth. But one day it was different. I walked by a room and I saw my dad bent over with his head in his hands. And I asked him, and as he looked up with eyes stained with tears and reddened from crying, he said, "It's different, Aaron, this time. Your sister is sick. She has a fever, and it won't go away." And I knew instinctively, because my dad had always been able to conquer everything. He had always been able to control everything. He was an important man, but this time it was different. He said, "She's dying." And in his despair, he said something that I didn't understand. He said, "Despair is a notch above dignity." As a child, I didn't comprehend that, but I guess he was trying to say that sometimes in desperation and despair, we try to elevate ourselves to encompass this dignity and not wanting to express our weakness, not wanting to express that we are wrong or weak or can't accomplish something. We hide in despair. But I remembered in my playing around in the neighborhood with the other children that maybe there was another possibility that we could explore. So I decided to suggest it to my father. I said, "Dad, have you heard about Jesus? We understand that he's been around this lake, the Sea of Galilee, and he's been over in Capernaum, and then he comes over on this side of the river, on the other side where Gerzenes live, I believe. And we hear these things about what he does. And, you know, he's got a house over here in Capernaum. Maybe we ought to go see him." And my dad looked at me and thought about it and considered it and said, "Yes, let's do that. What do we have to lose? Let's give it a try." So we began the journey to meet Jesus. And because my dad was an important man, he could push through the crowd a little bit, you see. They had to make way for my dad. He was the ruler of the synagogue. So we got up to the front where Jesus was, and my dad did something that really embarrassed me. I'd never seen my dad bow down to any man. He was the ruler of the synagogue. Everybody was carrying his briefcase. Everybody was doing for him. But he got down on his knees and said to this man, the story is there in Mark 5 and verse 22, "Behold, there came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus, by name. And when my father saw Jesus, he fell at his feet." I tell you, that was kind of embarrassing. You didn't want anybody to see your dad in such a prostrate state. "And he besought Jesus greatly, saying, 'My little daughter lies at the point of death. I pray you, I beseech you, I beg you, come and lay your hands on her. Come and touch her, that she may be healed, and she shall live.'" Well, Jesus simply responded by saying, "Take me to her. Let's go. Let's go. We're on our way. We're going to make this journey." And Jesus, in verse 24, went with him, and much people followed him and thronged him. He could not go anyplace. Earlier, when he was in Capernaum, he couldn't eat a meal without people coming around and bothering him and pestering him for some miracle or some healing. He chose to go with my dad that day. And as we were walking, there came a commotion from the back of the crowd. And as I turned to look and examine what the commotion was about, things kind of slowed down into slow motion. And up from the back of the crowd came this woman, pale of face, as if perhaps anemic, disheveled, pushing her way through. And everything stopped. The story is there. It's an amazing story. It's popularized in many songs. One that I've heard about, a man named Sam Cooke sang it many years ago with a group called the Soul Stirrers. They were a quartet, and the name of the song was, "There was a woman in the Bible days who had been sick so very long. But she heard that Jesus was passing by, so she joined the gathering throng. And while she was pushing her way through, someone asked her, 'What are you trying to do?' She said, 'If I could just touch the hem of his garment, I know I will be made whole.'" Powerful picture there. Powerful story. The touch that makes whole. Here's what Mark says. "And a certain woman, which had an issue of blood 12 years, and had suffered many things of many physicians." If I ask you to raise hands of those who've suffered at the hands of physicians, you could just go back paging through your checkbook and note it. "She spent all that she had and was nothing bettered, but rather grew worse. And when she heard of Jesus, came into the press behind the crowd and touched his garment. For she said within herself, 'If I may just touch but his clothes, I shall be whole.' And straightway the fountain of her blood," this hemorrhage that she had had for 12 long years, "was dried up. And she felt in her body that she was healed of that plague." An instantaneous circumstance, not a prolonged and protracted waiting. Instant. She knew it. And I was watching this with my dad. And at this moment, the importance of getting home took a back seat. For something was happening here that we had never seen before. Someone touched the master in the crowd, and we forgot about our agenda. And then, well, you see, when I was reading to you from Leviticus, this is where it enters in. She was unclean. She was impure, ceremonially and physically. In a state like that, she had to go and give the crowd a wide berth. She could not be out and amongst the crowd, for anyone she touched would be unclean and therefore ceremonially unclean to go and worship at the temple. She was doing something against the law. She was making a scene, making a mistake. But her motivation was pure and absolutely right. An outcast of 12 years touched the hem of his garment and was made whole. Think about it. Consider it. She saw a smile once she identified herself, it says. And it's an interesting thing, the way it all happened as I remember it. Christ said, "Somebody touched me." His disciples said, "Are you crazy? Look at this crowd around you. Anybody could have touched you. What do you mean somebody touched you?" He knew it was a different kind of touch, a different kind of significance to that touch. Verse 30, Jesus immediately, knowing in himself that power, virtue, had gone out of him, turned him about in the press and said, "Who touched my clothes?" His disciples didn't quite understand it. Verse 32, and he looked around, about to see her that had done this thing. She looked in his eyes. He returned the glance. The woman, fearing and trembling in verse 33, knowing what was done in her, knowing that something had changed within her, came and fell down before him and told him all the truth. And he gently, kindly said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you whole. Go in peace and be whole of that plague." Now, I got to tell you, that was an amazing thing for a teenager to see, to observe such an event. Now, I suspect that some view this passage of Scripture as well as other miracles and try and attempt some explanation, some physiological concept, some biological reality, something that would mitigate or weaken or water down Christ's power. Because, after all, you know, God doesn't do miracles anymore. Doesn't have to do miracles anymore. We've got doctors, you know. We don't need miracles. You go to see the physician. Well, this lady tried them all in her day. There are many today sitting even before me who's tried everything possible. But is this a digression in the midst of the story of my dad and my sister? It was an exciting moment. The crowd stopped and watched this scenario worked out before us. But weren't we wasting time? My sister was about to die. And certainly, what happened, happened. Verse 35, while he was talking to this woman, there came from the ruler, my dad's home, the ruler of the synagogue, certain who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why bother the master any further?" You see, they had a concept that death was the last frontier. Once you enter into death's domain, there is nothing to be done. But they didn't know to whom they spoke. Jesus, overhearing it in verse 36, heard the word that was spoken. But he said to my dad, "Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Only believe." We laugh sometimes at the Protestants who assert that all you have to do is believe. Well, there's a lot to believe. There's a whole Bible to believe, a whole creation to believe, and when you do, you wind up believing God. Simple belief, more complex than that, but that's what he told my dad. and we continued on the journey. But he didn't let everybody go along, because sometimes you have to shuck away those who would doubt, those who would impede your progress, those who would be anchors and obstacles in your way. You have to strip them away. You have to put them aside. It's awfully hard to do that. He suffered, permitted no man to follow him except Peter, James, and John. And he came to the house in verse 38, the house of my father, and he saw this crowd. You see, in those days there were these professional mourners, and they made their way about wherever there was a death, and they had all of the instruments, the tambourines and the flutes. There was a certain configuration of them. There were a couple of flautists or flutists playing, and others who mourned and made a lot of sound and groanings because they thought this was the way to do it. There were a lot of religious traditions and things that people thought that made them righteous. And so here they were making all of this noise, a tumult. And they wept and they wailed greatly. You've seen the scenes. You've seen the circumstances upon the death. And when he came in, verse 39, he said unto them, a powerful man, to be sure, a carpenter who had built his body up to a degree where he could demand attention just by his force of personality. He asked them, what are you doing? Why make you this ado and weep? Why are you carrying on like this? The young child is not dead, but sleep. They laughed him to scorn. And this was uncomfortable because I had just seen this woman with the hemorrhage healed on the road. I wasn't about to laugh. I wasn't about to consider it funny what he had to say. But they did. They had not been with us. They laughed him to scorn. So he had to take an action. He had to put them out. He put them out. He took my father and my mother in with him, along with Peter, James, and John, and entering in to where my sister was lying. He took my sister's hand. He touched her. And he said to her, Talitha kumi. Mark's record here in the Old English translation has it, damsel, I say unto you, arise. Probably it would be better if it had been said, Princess, get up. Didn't shout it. All the shouting had been put out of the room. He quietly touched her and brought her back from a region that was thought to be impenetrable, untouchable, no access here. And straightway, my sister arose and walked. She was about 12 years old, you know. And they were astonished with a great astonishment, to be sure. The witness was, from those who met us on the road, your daughter's dead. There's no reason to bother the master any further. It's over. Some believed in the resurrection, to be sure, but they knew that that was yet way down the road. For now, she is dead, and let's get on with the funeral. So there was a great astonishment. And he told everybody, verse 43, that no man should know it, and commanded that something should be given to her to eat. Now, I don't know what you're thinking. I don't know what you're considering when you look at this. But he took his time with my sister. He took his time and care with my parents, and he provided something for us that we could not do for ourselves. I hope that you can note a couple of things that I want to pass on to you today. There were more than issues of blood. There was an issue of impurity present, both by the woman's condition that we met on the road, but also the fact that my father and my mother witnessed this man touch a dead body. And The law said that if you did that, you were unclean for 7 days. But can you tell that to one who created the law? Can you tell it to one sovereign over the law? Can you paint him into a box and limit his access and his power? I say no. For he once said in his physical presentation, I am. Before Abraham was, I am. This is the one that John bore witness of, not only the Baptist, but the writer John, the Apostle John, that said there was nothing created without him. No, this was a special man who came to our house. The issue of impurity. He told us that there is a touch that makes one whole. And there's no waiting. There's no equivocation. There's no biding your time. The touch happens, and you are cleansed. You are whole. And the issue about the woman and her condition and the issue about Christ touching the dead body did not see the light of day. Oh, there were Pharisees lurking about saying, he touched the dead body. He can't go up to the temple for 7 days. This woman is, even if she's healed, and we'll have to kind of get some record of that, 7 days has to transpire before she can get up to the temple anyhow. But there is a temple where we have easy and instantaneous access, and you don't have to go through any physical human being to get to it. One just must reach out and touch the Master. Later on, Timothy was to write that God has given us, or Paul was to write to Timothy, God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and a sound mind. The issue of fear, note in the fourth chapter, verses 40 and 41. This is after Christ had been over and performed some miracles on the other side, in Capernaum, before he was to make a journey over to the Gadarenes location. And they got into a ship and were about to get off and get out into the deep, and a storm comes up. Not just any kind of storm, and I understand Bronson knows about a storm because he was down there in Jamaica when Gilbert came through. He understands a storm. I've never seen a storm in the States like he saw down there. Understands a storm. These disciples understood a storm too. And after the storm had been whipped up and the fear was upon them, notice what's happening here in verse 40. And Christ said to them, why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith? They had watched this man heal people left and right. And if he wanted to take a moment to go to sleep, let him sleep, because he's with you. What could possibly happen? But they feared, and they feared even more, in verse 41, exceedingly, and said one to another, we don't understand this man, because he has shown something here that, wow, he has power over the elements. What manner of man is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? Fear. Well, there's another fear that comes up. They get to the shore. He goes onto the shore, and here is a man possessed of a demon. They named him Legion because it had the manifestation of many demons. And nobody could do anything with him. Everybody had tried. They tried chains and shackles, and he would break them, and he would cause havoc and wreak havoc throughout the community, dwelling among the cemetery, the graveyards. But he cast the demon out of this man, showing that he had power over the spirit world. Power over the physical elements, no reason to fear them. Power over the spiritual world, no reason to fear. But this is what the crowd said in verse 15, chapter 5. And they came to Jesus, and after they saw this man who had been possessed with the devils, the demons, and had the many, the legion, sitting and clothed in his right mind, and they were afraid. The record is there continually throughout the Bible from Genesis to Revelation of the power of God in the face of things that seem to be impossible. They feared. Well, the woman feared too once she was healed. And her fear was a trembling of a sort that, well, did I do the wrong thing? I mean, are they going to find out that I've got this impurity, and am I going to be taken to the high priest and subjected to some kind of punishment? Verse 33, the woman, fearing and trembling, knowing what was done in her, came and fell down before him and told him all the truth. Well, I might as well confess it. And he told her, your faith has made you whole. You don't have to fear. You don't have to worry. You don't have to be concerned. My dad was fearful too. After all, when he saw this woman healed, and the representatives came from my dad's house saying, my sister was dead, verse 36, the master had to say, don't be afraid. Only believe. So there's an issue of fear present when we are faced with those mountains and those impenetrable walls. A fear. An uncertainty. Well, where do we go from here? There are some things that you might note that this woman had her hemorrhage for 12 years, and my sister was 12 years old. The woman had had this problem for as long as my sister had been alive. And yet, Christ had the power over it. Christ showed he had miraculous power over the winds and the waves, the forces of nature, the physical. He had shown that he had power over the spirit world of the demons. And he had the ultimate power even over death. What else do you need to know? What else do you want to know? What else do you have to consider? This woman on the road had been restored to a proper relationship with God. So had my dad. You don't hear about him anymore. You don't even hear about me. You don't even know if I actually existed. But you might consider that I could have been part of the 120. After all, Jesus came to our house, and his touch made us whole. Well, he doesn't always let the crowd follow along. He doesn't always let people even who he cures follow along, because the demonic wanted to go. Legion wanted to go. The one who had been possessed of the demon said, let me follow you wherever you go. And Christ said, no, you stay here and you tell the story to this community. It takes storytellers. It takes people to give a witness of what Christ has done in your life. We can argue about times and places and what it is that we should be doing at any given time in the course of the annual holy days. But what has he done for you personally? Do you know this man of Galilee? Sounds Protestantish? Still the truth. It still must be faced. It still must be determined within each of our minds, as it was determined on that day for me and my dad and my mom and my sister. God is. And he is a rewarder of them who diligently seek him. Sometimes you've got to press through the crowd, like the woman at the rear with the 12-year hemorrhage. You've got to get up there and touch the master. Well, there's a lot to be said that could be said. A lot we could go into. For instance, Jairus' name means he enlightens. My dad had a story to tell. Could he bring enlightenment after what happened that day? Yes, yes, he could. The woman? That woman, we don't even know her name. But look at the witness. 12 years, hemorrhaging. Suffered at the hands of physicians. How many can identify with that? Oh, yes. Spent her life savings. Is it becoming more relevant now? I mean, is it relevant now that you can relate to someone who has been sick for so long? Is it relevant now that you realize you could suffer at the hands of people who are supposed to know, but that's why they call it a practice? Doctor's practice, lawyer's practice, because they don't know everything. Spending your life savings? Somebody in here knows what I'm talking about. Somebody along the tape program knows what I'm talking about. And then get worse. But when you sum it all up, what she had to do, what my dad had to do, was decide to try Jesus. She was impure personally, physically, socially, and spiritually. But there is one who can make you whole with a touch. There is no reason to wallow in the strife of this life and to be incapacitated by it, conquered by it, to not be able to ride on the high places of this world. Your father owns cattle on 10,000 hills. When will you claim it? No, not name it, claim it. But there are promises, brothers and sisters, that must be embraced and must be acknowledged and must be reckoned with if we are to be empowered from the source that's going to carry us forward to do the job we've got to do. It's an amazing, amazing thing. When I said you have to press through the crowd sometimes to get to Jesus, we have many witnesses through the pages of the Bible of where that was true. Because sometimes when there is despair, you have to find hope. Sometimes when there is doubt, you have to find the faith. Pressing through the crowd and losing your dignity and your pride and grabbing the ankles of the Messiah is what's necessary. There's a song I thought I'd leave you with on this subject. Remember, the title of the song, the sermon, was "A Touch That Makes You Whole."
Shackled by a heavy burden, neath a load of guilt and shame, then the hand of Jesus touched me, and now I am no longer the same. For he touched me. Oh, he touched me, and oh, what joy doth flood my soul. Something happened, and now I know he touched me. And made me whole.
Press through the crowd and touch Jesus. He will return the touch.